The House Committee on Revenue for Tuesday, June 2nd, 2009 will come to order. Welcome all this morning. We'll open a public, we might as well start at the top, I think. We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 3405, and I think we're going to hear from the Legislative Revenue Office first.
Just now. I just read the synopsis. Hot, warm off the press.
It's still hot.
Good morning, Chair, members of the committee. Chris and I thought we'd describe our weekend project.
How you spent your beautiful weekend.
We just handed out a summary sheet that on one side is the -6 amendment to House Bill 3405. And on the other side is the -3 amendment to 2649. We met with council yesterday morning, and they worked all day on those amendments, and we just received them just prior to the meeting, so we haven't had a chance to go through them, but that's the latest that we have from them, and we'd like to spend a few hours this afternoon going through those and making sure that everything is as we had anticipated. I'll walk through the summary sheet with you, and then Chris can go through the detailed data he's gone through and looked at the distribution of the changes among taxpayers, both for the corporate and personal, and has preliminary revenue impact for you. So first, the summary sheet, it's labeled House Bill 3405-6 at the top, and it has the pieces of the revenue chairs, corporate business portion of the revenue plan, and the major change in this compared to the other version of 3405 that you talked about last week is a new C-Corp minimum structure to it. This moves away from a percentage of sales or gross receipts from the previous version to a tiered structure, and that is outlined there in the second block. So you can see it's based on Oregon sales. And for Oregon sales less than $500,000, it's $150. One thing I might note, I wrote the number of filers there on the side. That's from the 2006 data. And you'll see a little bit of a difference there. Chris has projected those out to 2009 on the impact, so you'll see those. But these are actual data for the number of filers in those sales categories in 2006. You can see how it moves up through to the highest category. There's 10 categories there. The highest is sales, so Oregon sales, greater than $250 million, would have a $100,000 minimum. By the way, the number of filers there are not the number paying the minimum, but the total number of filers in each of those categories. We anticipate that that structure would generate about $93 million in the 2009-11 biennium. It would first apply to the 2009 corporate tax year. And you can see that if you look out in the future biennium, we expect that to kind of drift down over time as the number of C-Corps have tended to decline over the last decade or so. The other pieces to the structure is $150 minimum for S-Corporations, so they would not be subject to this sales tiering. That's for C-Corps only. And then a new $150 entity tax for partnerships, LLPs, LLCs. These entities are required to file a form with the Department of Revenue. So those that file the particular form would then be required to pay $150 at that time. Of course, their tax payments, like the S corporations, are made through the personal income tax. And then there's a new Secretary of State filing fee structure. And the bill, and that new structure is down at the bottom. Under the current structure, all filings are $50. And this new structure would have a three-tiered approach. Nonprofit entities would have a $50 filing fee, which is the same as current law. There would be a new $100 filing fee for domestic corporations and a new $275 filing fee for corporations based outside of Oregon. And those are should be in the Dash 6. There's also some additional fee for notary fees, and those would be used to pay for Secretary of State additional costs. So what you see here, the $26 million, is the anticipated net revenue to the general fund from the additional filing fees. Finally, there's a new corporate rate structure that goes into place, and we anticipate that will generate $108 million in the 09-11 biennium. For the 09 corporate tax year, there would be a 7.9% rate on all net income above $250,000. Again, as you recall from the previous version you looked at last week, it had the same structure, only it was an 8.2% rate for net income above $250,000. So the 6-6, the current law 6-6 rate would continue to apply to net income below $250,000. And remember, this is a marginal rate. So even if your net income is $100 million, you're still going to have a 6.6% rate on the first $250,000. That rate drops to 7.6% for the 11-12 corporate tax years, again, with a two-tiered structure. And then in 2013, it goes to a new breakoff point on the 7.6, keeps the 7.6 rate, but raises that breakoff point up to $10 million. So it's for net income greater than $10 million would be the 7.6. For net income below that would be 6.6. And you can see the revenue projections out there. And even though in 11-13 you see a decrease in the tax rate, you still generate more revenue, and that's because we're anticipating that corporate base to start coming back as the economy recovers. So we expect the low point in corporate collections to be in the 09-11 biennium. So that's why you get that kind of anomaly of a higher revenue projection even with a lower rate. So those are the pieces of 3405-6. As you can see, the total generated from the bill, we expect to be about $261 million for the 09-11 biennium. As you recall, when the revenue chairs presented their plan, they included some additional revenue from reducing the Betsy credit, and that I'm not showing that here, as that's in Senate Finance and Revenue. On the other side of the sheet, the 2649-3, you can see the breakdown for the. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, have you opened the?
I haven't.
Okay, all right. So I'll wait.
Let's do them one at a time.
Okay.
That'd be great.
Okay.
Thank you.
I'll turn over to Chris to go through the details on the corporate side.
Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Chris Allen, Act, the Legislative Revenue Office. On the back of the preliminary revenue impact statement for House Bill 3405-6 is an estimated distributional impact table. And this is similar, the structure of the table is similar to the one you received last week. This one is for the policy Paul just described. And it has the breakdown for the Oregon sales categories according to each level of their minimum tax. And so we have the 33,593 projected total returns for tax year 2009, with the estimated minimum tax coming in at $46.3 million. And then we have the average tax impact, and that is for those that are affected by the minimum tax. So, for example, in the top category, those with Oregon sales of $250 million or more.
We're looking for it.
It's attached to the measured history.
Today's handout.
Today's handout.
Yes.
I think it's on your left. There you are.
There we go. It's in this pile. Excuse me.
Please, go ahead. Yeah.
There it is.
Okay, so getting back to the table, there's the minimum tax piece and then the marginal rate tax piece. And so in the minimum tax, we see that the total estimated revenue from the minimum tax for 09 is $46.3 million. That's in the bottom row there, total, with a minimum, the average impact of just under $1,800 and showing 77% of taxpayers affected. Now, as you may recall, under the current minimum tax structure, about two-thirds of the corporations pay the minimum $10. And so the difference here, you have those two-thirds who would be affected, plus both the corporations who pay more than the minimum under current law, but less than whatever the minimum is in this proposal, be it $150 up to the $100,000. So it's that marginal increase. And that average impact is for those that are affected. So, for example, in the bottom category, corporations with at least $250 million in Oregon sales, they're expected to be 107 of those corporations. 40% of them would be affected by this, and they would pay an average $95,430 more in corporate tax for a total of about $4.1 million. And then it's kind of the same story for each group, where the average minimum tax impact is a little bit less than the statutory. And then the percentage of corporations that are affected is in the third column there. Over on the right-hand square, for the marginal tax rate, it's the same kind of structure where in total $49.6 million is raised through the marginal tax rates. An average impact for those affected is $31,460, and 5% of all corporations are affected by the higher marginal rate. And you can see in that affected column, those less than 500,000 aren't really affected, or very few of them are affected, and then 1% of those with 500,000 to a million are affected. And then that percentage increases to roughly 50% for the top income group, or the top sales group. And so that's kind of the distributional impact, where that average increase goes from the low of about $2,800 for the 500,000 to a million category, and then upwards of $359,000 for the category of at least $250 million in Oregon sales.
Representative Berger.
This is only for 2009, these numbers.
Mr. Chair,
I'm trying to figure out where they're reflected on this.
This is a portion on that handout you have in your left hand under the 09-11 revenue impacts. It's a portion of the $93 million. The $93 million is a two-year impact.
And this is one
just
year.
In 1 year to show the distributional impact focused on one tax year.
Thank you. I'm trying to go
back and forth.
Connect them. Thank you.
So the minimum impact we're expecting to be relatively stable. So that's roughly half of that $93 million. And moving forward through 11-13 and 13-15, whereas for the new corporate tax rate, it's $49.6 million in 2009, and we're expecting that to grow as the economy improves.
Any other questions?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Going back to this handout, and just a quick question. When you guys did the modeling for this and the estimated revenue impacts, did you put it through the acronym, it's the OTIP model, the dynamic model, or is this a static analysis?
Representative Bruin, the OTIP model is a long-term model in which we're looking at what we think would be a near a full employment situation, comparing to that sometime in the future. Our concern now with the OTIM is that we're so far below full employment, and we're going through some pretty radical structural changes right now in the economy. We've frankly been not confident we'll produce meaningful results with that. So we've kind of got it on furlough until we can update the equations and to reflect the structural changes we see. These numbers are run through our standard micro-simulation model in corporate.
Okay, and then follow up. How would you categorize that, though? Would that be a dynamic model? Would that be, would the numbers generated from that assume that there's no change in behavior based on the change of tax rates, or would it assume there's a change of behavior based on the tax rates?
I would characterize these as static estimates.
Static estimates.
Yes.
Okay. So just for the record, Mr. Chair, we're assuming that corporations will, when we're showing these revenue estimates, that corporations and high income individuals will in no way change their behavior based on the change in tax rate. And I'm not sure that's justifiable, but I think it needs to be on the record for our conversation. Thank you.
As long as we're there, could you describe a little bit more why you think the OTIM model may be a problem for this analysis. And let me just add to that, what I think I heard a moment ago was that an echo of an idea that I've been hearing, and that is that with a recession like this one, there will be significant structural changes in the economy during the recovery, and that therefore the model based on the previous economy probably will not work, or it won't be very accurate. Comment on that comment, and also what you were saying a little bit more, if you could.
That's correct, Mr. Chair. We have several concerns. As I said, the OTIM model is a long-term model, it really is a supply-driven model. We're looking at these behavioral changes and how they might affect the supply of capital and labor in Oregon, how they might cause regional movement. Right now, the factor that's driving the economy is insufficient demand. So there's insufficient demand to employ all resources, so we are the full employment level. And the supply-side mechanism that operates within OTIM is really not very operational now until we begin to get near full capacity. And given the kind of projections we see now, we're not confident that that's going to happen anytime in the next 3 or 4 years. So in that sense, we're very concerned about a supply-driven model, which we think has good, solid theoretical basis based on recent history. But we don't think that's going to be real reliable in a period where we're so far below full capacity and we have kind of a classic demand-driven down cycle that's affecting the national and global economies. The other thing, the point you raised about the structural change, yes, I think Joe Courtright mentioned this to you in his testimony, that he envisioned that one of the consequences of this cycle was we were going to see a real speed up in structural changes as the economy comes back toward capacity. It's going to be a different industry mix to reflect some of those structural changes. And let's face it, there were some real distortions in the economy that preceded the recession that were not sustainable, and so those adjustments will take place. So we think that's going to require us to go in and update our information, our data, on our structural equations that drive the model to give us a better sense of how those interrelationships work. The other thing that might come into play as well is one of the assumptions about OTIM is that we change our policy parameters here in Oregon, and the underlying assumption is nobody else changes theirs.
Yeah, right.
So, which I think there is a certain stability out there in terms of general state and local fiscal policy. So it makes sense, I think, in over the last couple of decades. But in this current environment, we think that's probably not a very good assumption because all the states in the neighboring area and in the country are under this fiscal crisis, and we're likely to see some significant changes in policy as a result of that.
Thank you. It sounds as though what you're saying is that the OTIM model may have some significant limitations for the foreseeable future until it's restructured to reflect what actually comes out of this recession.
I think that's true, Mr. Chair. It is dependent on, and all of these models are dependent on a given structure.
Yeah.
So if that structure changes, then those models are producing less reliable results. And frankly, I mean, we see the same issues faced across the street trying to make the quarterly projections. I mean, they obviously can't go on hiatus to do that. But, those are the same kind of issues that are affecting the forecast, is those relationships are less reliable given the changes we've seen. So one of our interim projects is to spend some time updating those equations and see if we can find a way to respond to the new environment for the model. Because we think it is a tool for you that would be useful over time, and particularly for longer-term major changes in the revenue structure. We still think it can be a useful tool in the future, but we'll need to update it to reflect these changes.
Mm-hmm. Of course, a comment, and then I'll go to Representative Bentz. It seems to me that we are doing our best as a state government to assist in that change of structure. I mean, some of the other bills that we'll be looking at, that we've already looked at, are intended to help change that structure long term. Mm-hmm. So it's not surprising that not only will economic realities lead to a change of structure, but hopefully we can nudge them along a little bit in the direction that will benefit Oregon. Representative Bantz.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually two questions, and they both have to do with the C-Corp minimum structure. The first is, what is the rationale for that minimum movement up? In the old days, it was one flat amount for all. Now there is a movement up. That's one question. The second has to do with your thoughts on the difference between making a C-Corp pay a minimum and S-Corp not. And the S-Corp ends up paying a $150 minimum. I know it's a pass-through device, so two questions.
Representative Bantz, I can kind of tell you how we work through these, but I think you're really kind of getting into some policy questions, and maybe the chair could respond to several of those. As you recall, on the corporate minimum structure, we've kind of gone through. We've started out in this hearing room in this committee talking about the different cases. We had a discussion about that several months ago and looked at what the alternative is, the net income versus the value added versus the gross receipts. We had done considerable work on looking at a business activity type approach that would be based on the returns to the factors of production, labor and capital. Moved away from that toward a modified gross receipts base in your previous version of this bill and had a percentage of gross receipts. And this is kind of a step away from that to go to a sales, that same base, but to have these structural categories in there so there would be more certainty as to what your tax liability would be for these given segments. And that's kind of the feedback, I think, that was given by the business community, is that was preferable to having a continuous function where you had some percentage of gross receipts. So that was the kind of the steps that went through in terms of that evolving into this tiered structure that you see now. The other element in terms of the S corporations, I think this decision, you know, of making a distinction goes back, you know, and really the first effort at this that we were involved in 2003 had a similar kind of distinction between S corps and C corps. Of course, now all of the S corps pay the $10 minimum. All roughly 55,000 of them pay the $10 minimum. All their income is passed through, so they only have $10. So, for example, in 2003, there was a two-tiered structure set up for S corps at 250 and 500 based on their gross sales. This approach is just raising that $10 to 150, which is equal to the minimum for the smallest C-Corps, and then I think the decision here is to recognize that their income is paid as a pass-through, and then the personal income tax would pick up those additional, would pick up that income flow.
Please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the recognition is that it's a pass-through, and thus the personal income tax return is going to be a higher rate than the C-Corp rate. Is that the thought?
Yes.
I see. Okay, thank you for that.
Others? Okay, let's see what we have in terms of public testimony. Well, let's start with Tui Smith and Marion Haynes. Good morning.
Good morning. Chair Barnhart, committee members, my name is Marion Haynes. I'm with the Oregon Business Association. I'll try to be fairly brief. I just wanted to make sure that I came and gave you all an update of what we've been doing on this issue since I was down testifying when this last came up a week ago Friday with our board chair, Mike Morgan. Following that meeting, we, the legislative leadership of both chambers, contacted us and asked to set up a meeting with our Economic Crisis Task Force that had developed the plan and some of our leadership. We did that last Wednesday. I think all agree that we had a very constructive dialogue, productive conversation around some of the issues that we found problematic with the proposal you last saw. And we heard some of their concerns as well about revenue impacts and that carrying over into the next biennium as well. As you know, and we said last time we were here, when we put our plan out there, we really viewed it as a plan and what was the responsible amount that the business community could do without tipping the scale and making things worse. It wasn't really a starting point for negotiations. That being said, we did have a very constructive dialogue last Wednesday, and we did go back and make some modifications to our plan. The minimum tiers we adjusted slightly so that on the high end the number came up to $50,000 versus $25,000. Our members are really telling us that $50,000 on the minimum is really where the cutoff needs to be. We really shouldn't be going higher than that. We also, originally our proposal had a surcharge increase in the rate temporary for to 7.6, we bumped that up to 7.9, and rather than phasing down over 3 years, we phased down over 4 years in recognition of the concerns about the 11-13 budget. All in all, those changes to our proposal, which we gave to legislative leadership on Friday, came out to $220 million. Again, we think that these were, we stretched a little bit farther than we thought that we had in the beginning. We also committed that we will have a conversation with legislators about the long-term structure of our tax system. We don't think right now is the time to make any permanent changes, and the proposal before you does have some changes that are permanent in the corporate excise tax rate. The minimum we've always been okay with making permanent. Representative Brune, to your point, we tried very hard in our plan to balance the need for revenue to deal with this short-term crisis that we're in and not changing business behavior. That's a very real possibility that we need to look out for, both on the personal and the corporate side, because there's a hydraulic that works between those two. We will have an executive committee this afternoon that meets at 3:30. We'll be taking up both of these issues. That being said, we are getting feedback from our members and are still hearing a lot of concerns about the proposal before you, about the permanent nature of some of the changes on the corporate excise tax. The level of the minimum that's set in the tiers now is very, very high, and we're very concerned about that. And the different treatment among businesses and trying to really call out those larger businesses, we really think that there needs to be a uniform treatment across all businesses. So we look forward to continuing this discussion with you. We'll have a more decisive statement coming out of our executive committee later today, but did want to let you know that we had been engaging in those conversations with leadership. We thought they went very well. We did go back and try to stretch a little bit and put a plan on the table that we could support and we could get behind that gets you $220 million. And we'll see if that's where we ultimately land. I have a feeling it is. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Good morning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Tootie Smith, representing the Oregon Family Council, representing 1,800 churches and celebrating our 25th anniversary this year. I come to you today to talk about struggling families across the state of Oregon, of which includes business owners in the cities and in the country where we have natural resources. My client and the families who I've talked to, business owners who I've talked to, who include myself, view this tax as grossly unfair. At a time where we all admit that we have a sea change of what's happening in corporate and business America. We do not know where we're going to end up a year from now or even 2 years from now. Our policy is, why change anything at this point? I understand, because I have been in your shoes in the 01, 02, and all these wonderful special sessions that we had, and I was on Ways and Means, and we did consider some of the same things you're considering today. In retrospect, I am thankful that we did not implement a sea change of tax structure like you're considering today. Because viewing that recession, we came out of it a little bit easier than I think we're going to come out of this one. When you're a struggling business owner and you have a large tax burden to look at, for instance, as a gross sales tax, you tend to make a decision. Well, who am I going to pay at the end of the year? Do I pay my vendor? Do I lay off people? And when you lay off people, you lay off jobs and you lay off income for families. And I see what's happening in this building at the overall picture. I don't see how you can make this type of decision in a bubble without viewing all the other tax increases and fee increases that have been considered. On another note, I'm a fourth-generation farmer in the state of Oregon. My family has grown, raised, and probably lost and made money at every commodity that is available in this state. Our rural resources are struggling desperately, and in light of no progressive policy regarding our natural resource industries in this state, I don't see the legislator trying to promote our natural resource industry, which is a way for generating new monies. I would really caution to be very serious and very deliberate in what you do today. The tax that you're going to raise on this, viewed on the Dash 6 amendments, the $110 million or whatever it is hardly enough to offset the billions and billions of spending that we've endured in the last several sessions in this building. And unfortunately, we are becoming a state where we're going to have the haves and the have-nots. And I would just be very careful in your consideration of any more tax increases on our people. And I'd be happy to talk about the personal income tax when you view that, too.
Thank you very much. Questions for this panel? Thank you. We appreciate your testimony. Peter Threlkill. Ah, there he is. Good morning.
Good morning. Chair Bernhardt, members of the committee, my name is Peter Threlkill. I'm the director of the Secretary of State's Corporation Division and here to speak with you about House Bill 3405. My written testimony was originally drafted for the Dash 3 amendments, and I just received the Dash 6 this morning, so I'll try to speak more to the Dash 6. These are very close to the suggestions that we had made to the chair and to the revenue office for addressing changes with the fees that are charged by the Secretary of State's office. Specifically, we felt that it was important to look at a three-tiered structure for business registration fees, and that really returned Oregon to the more progressive system that we had in 2001 and prior, where our smallest, what I would call micro businesses, these are the assumed business names, nonprofit corporations who are primarily staffed by volunteers, very low-funded companies. Basically, let's keep them at the fee of $50. In 2001, they paid $10 a year to maintain their registrations. They're currently at $50. That's five times the rate they were paying 8 years ago. It seems very excessive to try to raise them higher, and I think the Dash 6 really respects that and keeps them whole. The for-profit, Oregon for-profit companies would go to $100 for their registrations. This is pretty much in line with our information. The third page of your testimony shows a breakout of fees charged by our counterparts in other states. And when we look at the Oregon corporations and limited liability companies, there's a range of fees, but essentially the averages are very much in line with what's proposed in 3405-6. The out-of-state corporations, the bill would take them to $275 for their filings, and again, very much in line with Oregon's past practice. We used to charge them $440 to file for an application for authority to do business in Oregon, and then $220 a year for their annual report and other document filings. So we're going back to that structure. This is what's in place in most other states. It's how most other states treat out-of-state companies when they come into their marketplace. A couple of other things that the bill does. It makes an increase in the uniform commercial code filing fee that we charge when a creditor needs to perfect a lien and file that with our office for personal property. The fee was last changed in 1993, so over 15 years ago, and we'll bump it up to $15 per filing. That's an increase of $5. The national average is about $20. The four-year commission for a notary public would go from $20 to $40. Again, over 20 years ago was the last change in 1989. And the national average is about $33, so we'd be just a little bit above the average there. One of the things that we'd hoped to accomplish in the bill was to be able to continue to improve services, existing services of government that are offered to Oregon's business community. We've built and hosted the Central Business Registry as a one-stop shop for businesses that want to register with the state, whether it's with the Secretary of State or the Department of Revenue, Department of Employment, or Consumer and Business Services. You can do all that through our website, one application. We want to expand that out to licensing agencies, to local governments, to the IRS, so that it truly is a one-stop shop, a process that used to take days and weeks now takes minutes and hours for a business. So we believe it's been very successful. We'd like to continue that effort. We think it's important to make those types of investments in increasing government efficiency and service to business. I would have to answer any questions.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Berger.
Peter, I presume you would know this. In this Dash 6 proposal, is all I have in front of me is this thing that was just passed out, and it describes the three-tiered corporate filing fee structure. I would assume that domestic corporations would include both S-corps and C-corps. Would it include LLCs, LLPs, or do you know?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Berger, yes, it would include all of the above. So any of the for-profit corporations, LLCs, limited partnerships, limited liability partnerships, professional corporations, an S-corp, a C-corp, all those groups that are in the for-profit category would see their rate go to $100.
Thank you. From the current 50.
From the current 50.
Thank you.
Other questions? Thank you. We appreciate your testimony very much. Jenna Kalba, Paul Romaine. Good morning.
Good morning. Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jenna Kaluza, and I am with...
Sorry.
That's okay. I'm with the National Federation of Independent Business here in Oregon. I've already testified on this bill. I just wanted to touch base again with the committee with the new amendments. We still believe that the last thing we should do is restructure the state's tax system in the middle of an economic crisis. Many of our same comments apply to the amendments that I testified to last time. And I'd also like to point out, Chair Barnhart, that it sounds as though there might be some discussions going on with leadership and business group, one business group in particular, about some of the proposals on the table. And I represent small business. It's been discussed many times in this committee that any proposals that are being discussed, you want to protect small business. We would really like to come to the table and talk to you about some of the opportunities that you're looking at and some of these proposals, and see if there's anything that we can add in showing you how our small businesses actually run their business and how some of these proposals will hurt or help their everyday activities. So, like I said, we have some of the similar concerns that we've had. We still do not think that the amendments get to protecting small business. Many of my members fall in many of the categories of the brackets that you have listed. It will still dramatically increase their corporate minimum. We, like I've said before, we don't feel that total sales is a good reflection of how large or small a business is here in Oregon. Many of my businesses are considered very small, but they have a very high gross sales. And we still don't feel that this is a good way to increase the corporate minimum. I want to outline again the three principles that my board signed off on and say again that we've discussed this topic at large and have agreed that the $10 minimum should be updated, but want to stick to three guidelines when doing that. The first was being that any change must be temporary. The second is that any adjustment to C corporations or LLCs or should only be to C corporations and should not be to LLCs or S corps. And the last, that any change to the minimum should not change the calculation to gross receipts or business activity and should just change the minimum as it is. I'm happy to take questions and, again, would really appreciate maybe an opportunity to sit down with leadership and discuss small businesses in the state and how these proposals will affect them. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Paul Romaine, an attorney in Portland, and I'm representing the Oregon Petroleum Association. Just an example, and then maybe a little suggestion. A 40,000-gallon per month station, very small station. In fact, you know it's very small because the DEQ does not even require that station to do what's called stage one vapor recovery because it's too small and not economical, would pay the minimum tax of $2,000 under this proposal. Now, the problem, I'm not a tax attorney and I'm new to this game, but it seems like we keep looking in the wrong place. It's what are the question I would be asking if I were in your shoes is, what are the deductions that we are allowing out there to taxable income that, or to gross income, that cause the taxable income to be so low? What is the problem out there? For us in the gas business or the grocery business, it's simply the cost of goods sold. There's no other exotic, weird things that we have out there. But what is it that's causing the taxable income to be low? And that's where I would focus. And rather than trying to set up this minimum that goes across or set up categories or whatever, different businesses have different ways of getting to bringing in income. And what's left over, if it's a lot of taxable income, then great, tax it. I don't have any problem. I've never had a problem with income tax because it's income. You've made it. It's after you've taken away all the deductions. So maybe that's where you should be looking rather than this tier of minimum taxes, basically saying, oh, my God, the deduction portion of it is just too complicated to look at. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As you probably know, we've looked at those deductions repeatedly, and every time we do, we have 25 or 30 people sitting where you're sitting telling us that we're doing it wrong. And so, you know, I understand what you're saying, and I actually believe what you're saying is correct, but we don't seem to be able to do that either.
Mr. Chair, Representative Riley, I understand the concept of political will, and it is difficult, I realize, because I'm one of those people who usually sits out here, although I've never been out there on deductions. I can actually That's claim true. Purity in that area.
Thank you very much. Other questions? On that note, thank you. We appreciate your testimony. Christine Chin Ryan.
Yeah. Good morning.
Good morning, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee. My name is Christine Chin Ryan, Chair of the Oregon Small Business Responsible Leadership. I had signed on as in support of this amendment to 3405. I want to give some encouragement. It's very close to our tier structure that the Oregon Small Business Responsible Leadership had proposed. However, there are still some issues there that I think could be tweaked. And last time I testified, I said we focus on small businesses. The $1 million to $10 million range, I think, needs to be looked at. I am not addressing some of the larger growths because we're focused on small businesses, but I do want to commend the committee for the tax structure. I think it's like I say, it was a structure that we proposed. We are in support of the corporate filing fees. We think it's reasonable. We don't want to reduce any of the state services or bring it down to a level that it's not feasible. So we do believe in shared responsibilities. Right now, as far as the excise tax, we are not making a stance. I think we leave that up to the big corporations. But other than that, I think it's a good direction, but I do would like you to look at some of the layers, particularly that how it affects small businesses. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Okay. Roger Martin? Oh, there he is. Standing in the shadows.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Roger Martin. I represent Alaska Airlines. Alaska has the duty of representing the ATA, the Air Transportation Association, which is all the airlines in the states of Oregon, Washington, and Alaska. And I need to pass on to you our concerns collectively about the minimum tax. Most all of the airlines are in the losing category right now. Alaska lost something over $50 million in the first quarter of reported income this year. Our sales are high. All of the major airlines will fall in those categories from 30,000 minimum up to 100,000. Alaska will be in the $100,000 tax because our sales in Oregon are $250 million. We have high sales. We're losing money. Now, you've heard the old thing about corporations don't pay much in the way of taxes, and I want to emphasize, I said to this committee one time before, we pay over $4 million in property taxes, mainly at PDX. We pay all the airlines pay the cost of expansion and operation of PDX. That's how the Port of Portland runs that airport. We pay millions of dollars in landing fees to use the airport. We also have a payroll of about 2,000, a little less than 2,000 people in the state of Oregon. It's around $85 million. Those are high-income people who pay a proportionally high personal income tax. We pay a minimum corporate tax. My only concern, the concern I want to voice to you, is that at $100,000, that will be 20, I emphasize, 20 times higher than we pay in any other taxing district in the 20 states that we serve. That's bound to have an effect. I can tell you, we've been talking to corporate headquarters in Seattle. They're concerned. My concern, and I'm not going to tell you because I don't set corporate policy, that they're going to change their habits, but it's been, you have an impact when you do these things. One of the things that I've tried very hard to do and the Port of Portland's tried is to get the Alaska Airlines to commit to further flights, such as direct flights to the East Coast. Every politician in this state who has gone from this chamber, these chambers, to the Congress would love to have a direct flight, and that's on the board for the next step for Alaska Airlines. I'm very concerned this Alaska look at it and say, at that tax level, why in the heck should we do business more direct flights out of PDX when we have the option to fly directly out of San Francisco, Sacramento, other states on the West Coast? I just want to bring that to your attention, Mr. Chairman. We're very concerned. I think you'll find this four or five major airlines in the state of Oregon will fall in those top tax categories, and it's going to be an extremely high rate compared to anywhere else they do business. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Questions for Mr. Martin? Thank you very much. And with that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3405 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2649. And I think we're going to repeat. Okay.
Paul Warner, Legislative Revenue Office. The Dash 3 amendments, as in the case of the 3405-6, these we got out this morning at 7:30. So, again, we need to go through these. I think you'll find that these amendments, however, are closer to the amendments you looked at last week. And I'll talk about those changes. On the other side of your summary of 3405-6, you'll see the 2649-3 summary. And the key elements that were in the previous version are also in this one. First of all, there is a phase-out for the federal tax subtraction. As you recall, this has a capacity amount now of about $5,800. And this phases out between, for joint filers, between $250,000 and $300,000. So there's a tiered phase out to prevent a cliff effect. For single filers, it's between $125,000 and $150,000. The phase out is tied to adjusted gross income. So that's a distinction between that and the higher rate. So it's tied to the phase out begins with $250,000 joint AGI. Like the previous version, it establishes new tax rates for high income brackets and establishes these tax rates for the starting with the 09 tax year, 09, 10, and 11 tax years. And those rates are the same as the previous version you saw. 10.8%, now this is for taxable income, not AGI, but taxable income, greater than $250,000 for a joint filer, but less than $500,000. And then for joint filers with income above $500,000 is 11%. So again, that's a marginal rate that kicks in for that increment of income above those thresholds. Chris will go through the distribution tables with you to show you who's affected and show you some examples. The change in this version compared to the previous one is that it consolidates the rates and beginning with the 2012 the tax year, consolidates and lowers the rates at that time to 9.9% marginal rate for $250,000 and above joint, 125 and above single. So beginning in the 2012 year, it would come down to 9.9, and that would be permanent under this until the laws changed. Also, as in the previous version, there is a connection, and we've talked a little bit about the language on this. What you're doing here is connecting to a one-year exclusion on unemployment compensation up to $2,400 for the 2009 tax year. And you can see our estimated impact there is about $32 million, but that would be a one-year thing, so it would not have an impact going forward. So the net of those elements is an 09-11 increase in revenue of $472 million. And then in the out years, the 9.9% bracket comes into play, and you can see we're looking at about $375 million per biennium for the next two biennium going forward.
Mr. Chair, members
of the committee. Let me ask you, do we actually have the Dash 3s?
You do have the Dash 3s, yes.
Okay, I don't seem to have it. Do other people have it?
I do not, Mr. Chair.
Got everything set to go.
Okay. Okay, please, go ahead.
Okay, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Chris Allenack, Legislative Revenue Office. Also in your packet, you have a distribution table. It looks like this. It's actually identical to the one that you received last week, and that's because it's for tax year 2009, and the policies for 2009 haven't changed. So I won't belabor that. It does show that you have the distribution for all returns lumped together, and it shows the impact on the top three income categories, those with at least $100,000 of income. The top three categories are $100,000 to $200,000 of income, $200,000 to $500,000, and those with $500,000 or more of income. And so you have the total distribution there. And then we also have subtotal distributions. You have a single filer distribution and a joint filer distribution to show the concentration of where the impact occurs at the top end of the distribution scale. That table also, just as a reminder, shows the impact on federal tax, because as the income tax increases for those filers who itemize their deductions, their deduction for state income taxes on their federal return will increase, and their federal tax liability will go down a bit, and that's reflected in the table as well. The new information is on the back side of that sheet, actually, and it has some examples of how to try and get at more specifically how certain types of taxpayers would be affected. So I have here put together four examples, three joint filers and one single filer. And joint A is the first joint filer, and this is a family of four with $150,000 of income. Now, that income can come from any source. It can come from wages, it can come from capital gains, it can come from S corporation income. So, but that $150,000 level of income, and running that through the calculations shows a federal net tax of just over $16,000, and the Oregon tax of $9,823, and they are unaffected by the proposal at hand. They are joint returns, so they're affected by neither the phase out of the federal tax subtraction, because they're below the 250, and then their taxable income is $120,000, so it doesn't hit the $250,000 mark. Joint B example is a filer who would be affected only by the phase out of the federal tax subtraction. Their federal AGI is $265,000, and so on the line below Oregon taxes, for federal taxes, we see that their federal tax subtraction would be reduced from $5,850 to $3,500. And then that flows to a tax difference of $211, and that's simply the 9% at the reduced federal tax subtraction. The joint C family, it has $400,000 of AGI, so they would be affected by both the phase-out of the federal tax subtraction as well as the higher income tax rates. And we can see there that they're under the Oregon tax group, their tax line goes from Oregon taxes goes from $30,985 to $33,540, or an increase of $2,555. And just for the sake of simplification, I haven't included all of the interactive effects. There's a time element involved in that, and that $2,555 could actually would reduce their federal liability. That's not shown in the examples here, just for the sake of clarity. And then the last example is single filer A. They have AGI of $200,000, and we can see that under their federal tax subtraction, under the Oregon tax, they lose all of their federal tax subtraction. It's reduced from the $5,850 in current law down to zero. That's completely phased out. They're above the $150,000 AGI level. And their taxable income is $166,000, so it's above the $125,000, and so they're affected by the higher income tax rate as well. And their taxes would go from $14,620 to just over $16,000 for an increase of $1,384. So these are just some examples of certain filers where they land on the income range and how they would be affected, focusing on the high-end folks who are who are affected by the proposal.
Very good. Thank you. Questions?
Yes, Representative Brown.
Just for the record, Mr. Chair, I think it's probably similar to the last conversation, but this assumes no change in tax behavior. It's a static analysis of the revenue impact. Correct. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Correct.
Thank you. Let's hear from Tootie Smith.
Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Tootie Smith, Oregon Family Council. Regarding my testimony for the income tax increase, ditto. In this time of uncertainty, we have no idea where we're going. But what can I see, and the Oregon Family Council sees, families are having a very, very hard time making ends meet. And to make a decision as critical as this, I would really be careful. I would caution, you know, to be very caring on the personal income tax. Now, this pass-through income of $125,000 of adjusted gross income that comes through a C-Corp, they're taxed at one level at the C-Corp on gross sales. The income flows through to, on your personal income tax, they're taxed there. I think in one of the amendments I read, they're taking away the federal deduction for Oregon taxes. And then we also have a federal income tax. Well, not only is that double, triple, I think it's quadruple taxation and try to balance our budget. I would urge again, caution in not implementing this tax. Thank you.
Question, Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You talk about struggling families, and are you saying that people who have taxable income, families of taxable income more than $250,000 are struggling? Is that what you're saying?
Well, what I'm saying is the way this is written, the pass-through income from the corporations of $125,000 on adjusted gross income could conceivably be struggling families, because if it's just the taxable income.
Follow up?
Yeah, please.
So, I'm struggling with this, maybe more than those $250,000 families. I don't quite understand how the connection is made between struggling families and $250,000 income. I don't get it.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Riley, in economic times like this, I don't think we can tax our way out of debt. I don't think we can borrow our way out of the debt. I don't think we can tax our way out of the enormous amount of spending that has been going on to try to furnish programs to people across the state of Oregon.
So it really isn't about struggling families. It's about your view of how the state is spending the money.
I think those go hand in hand.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Bruin?
Mr. Chair, just for the record, we could discuss what a struggling family is at an individual 125 or a couple at 250. Keep in perspective that we're still not talking about wealth here, and a single dad, if you will, making a good income at 125 if he's paying for two or three kids in college is certainly not a rich person. But I want to go and talk about, for the record,
Representative Bruin, if I may, that if he's filing as head of household, he would qualify for the $250,000 limit before the new tax kicks in, not the $125,000.
Okay. You're right, Mr.
In Oregon, there are three categories for the federal tax, single, head of household, and joint. In Oregon, there are only two, and if I understand it correctly, head of household on the federal becomes joint for Oregon.
Okay. The second point I'd like to make, Mr. Chair, is that when we were talking about the previous bill, 3405, talking about a shift in, as it relates to this bill, we're talking about a corporate tax change that would move the corporate C-Corp rate from the current 23rd highest in the nation to 11th highest. When we're talking about S-Corps that fall under this new tax plan under this the bill we're talking about right now, that would move S-Corps to the highest taxed corporate entity in the nation. We would be number one in how we tax that particular tranche of corporations, for the record.
Well,
based on the handouts that we were given by Chris.
It's a useful point, but of course there's a difference in the way we tax S-corporations from the way we tax C-corporations, and the key difference that nobody thinks about, I think, is that when income is distributed to the shareholders in a C-corporation, it's taxed first at the corporate level as income, and then again at the individual level as income based on the dividend. So I don't know how you slice and dice it, but when you're all done, the income flowing from a C-corporation ends up being taxed at a higher rate if it's distributed than income on an S corporation does.
Well, Mr. Chair,
even under this proposal,
I think at some point, given what we're talking about, and given that so many of Oregon's small business fall under S corps, we do need maybe some sort of hearing on exactly how this will affect the current structure and how this will affect S corps, because I think there's a few of us that have questions about exactly how this will affect those companies.
Given the fact that's where
companies have filed over recent years, and you see a much larger trend toward S corps and away from C corps, I think it's critical that we understand exactly what these tax increase ramifications are going to be on those small businesses.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. I appreciate that, and I think that's a very reasonable approach. Simply to point out again that I think part of the reason why people are moving to S corporations is that the tax situation is actually quite a bit more favorable for those who plan to distribute most of their income anyway, if they can manage it. C corporations are usually C corporations because of the rules that govern when you can be an S corporation, fewer shareholders and the like. Anyway, thank you, and thank you very much for your testimony. And with that, we'll close the hearing on House Bill 2649. And colleagues, I'm hoping that we will be ready to move these two bills that we've just heard tomorrow. There is some conversation about the possibility of moving them to the Ways and Means Committee, because there is consideration about adding some of the expenditure items, like, for example, pieces of the proposals from the Secretary of State's office for his operation or her operation, and also a possible allocation of particular areas for some of the other taxes. So stay tuned for that, and we'll talk about that in work session tomorrow. Representative Berger.
Yes, I have prepared amendments for 3405. Would it be possible that those be distributed to members today?
I think they have been, haven't they?
No,
they haven't. All right.
Not, but
I think it's perfectly fine to do that.
So that they have them in their packets
let's
tomorrow.
Let's.
And I will. We're not in work session, so I won't discuss them. But I would like them distributed.
But I think that's an excellent idea. And what you gave to me was the -7.
That is correct, and I gave it to you. But they have not yet been distributed to the committee
members.
Thank you.
Let's distribute it, and thank you very much for pointing that out. Okay. Let me just for work handling the agenda. Let me point out that there are some difficulties with House Bill 2531, having to do with the fiscal contained in the bill that we need to work out. So we're not going to open that work session today. Now I have to find my agenda.
Good.
House Bill 2180 needs a fiscal, so we won't open that one today. I don't see Representative Kotek. Is she here?
Her staff is here.
She's coming. All right. So we'll open a work session on House Bill 2904. Okay, and we'll hear from the Department of Revenue. Dave, did you want to talk about the -2?
Excuse me, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee. The oral representative will explain the details of -2 amendment.
Okay.
But to refresh your memory, House Bill 2904 expands the definition of farm use for the purpose of special assessment in property taxation to include the implementation of a plan to remediate or mitigate severe adverse conditions on a farm parcel.
Okay. Gentlemen, thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is John Phillips from the Department of Revenue. Thank you. Representative Kotek, I believe, is intending to speak about the purpose for the bill that she sponsored, but maybe I can give a little background.
Right.
The you routinely review tax credits, tax exemptions, and special assessments to encourage certain behaviors or discourage others. In this case, we're dealing with something you might not have dealt with this session yet, and that's farming the land in Oregon. There's a special assessment for the property tax for farming, and it reduces the value on which the land is taxed if the individual, family, or persons actually farm the land. There are some minor exceptions to that in law. For example, laying ground fallow for 1 year does not penalize a property owner. So they retain the special assessment so long as they farm or lay the land fallow. A situation has arisen, which, again, the representative will speak to, and it's changing the program in certain ways, and we've worked with Representative Kotek's patience in helping us deal with all of the administrative issues that come up with this and putting sideboards so that the program changes can work on a going-forward basis.
Thank you. The Dash 2 works administratively for you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, yes. The Dash 2 is the version that we believe puts some sufficient sideboards on to allow for people to gain a plan for remediating their property when severe adverse conditions occur to land, which could be as a result of flooding or fire or fungus or any other type of calamity that might occur beyond the control of the farmland owner. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Gary Wright. I'm a farm use specialist for the Department of Revenue since 1990.
And, Mr. Chair, Gary's been of critical help on this in getting through the details with the owners of the farm, the Fazios, with Sean Cleve from the Farm Bureau, who has worked tirelessly on this, and with Representative Kotek. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions for this panel? Representative Bentz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The paragraph on page 10, then, paragraph 4, sub A, that's designed to correct the mechanism of recapture in the event that the property becomes disqualified from the farm use category. Was that what one of the changes the department made or worked in making? The question is this. If, as I understand it, if you take the farm use property out of farm use, then there's a recapture event looking back 10 years. And I just wanted to make sure that, indeed, this has been addressed, and I'm sure it has, and that's what I see on that page appears to do exactly that. Am I correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bentz, I'll give you a little bit of a longer answer on that. There are two main types of property, and Gary will correct me and jump in when I make a mistake, but exclusive farm use land and non-exclusive farm use land. And the look back, when you take land out of farming, you've been receiving a special assessed value and you take it out of that farm use. There's a 10-year look back for exclusive farm use, land that's in an area outside an urban growth boundary, and there's a 5-year look back for non-exclusive farm use. So we recapture that. But provisions of this bill say that if you take your land out of farm use and you're remediating the severe adverse condition for 5 years, let's say, that the recapture is the same 5 or 10 year plus the years of remediation, so that it prevents anyone from just taking their farm out of farm use and then just selling it as industrial land at the end of the remediation. Now, the Section 10 that you're referring to, I believe on page 12, Representative Bentz, is a section that actually is crafted just for the individuals that are caught in this situation at the present time. As far as we know, there's only one farm in the state that's in that situation.
Thank you.
Other questions? Thank you very much. I see Representative Kotek is here. And Representative Kotek.
Mm-hmm.
Morning, Mr. Chair, colleagues. For the record, Tina Kotek, State Representative, House District 44. Thank you so much for hearing this bill. And I want to say thank you to the Department of Revenue working on this. When we had the public hearing, we did have some concerns raised that we were trying to address, and it's taken a little time, but I think we have a good product. You did, you have the dash twos in front of you. They do some clarifications. Making clear, if you'd like, I can go through the dash twos. I have some comments, or I could just take questions. What would be your pleasure? I know you have a full agenda.
Well, seeing that the department is happy with the administrative changes, I think maybe it's preferable to take questions rather than going through the whole thing. Representative Bailey.
Mr. Chair, I was just going to say I'd be curious to hear the representative's take on the dash twos, but
yeah, no, that's fine.
If we can do
that.
Yeah.
Certainly.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative.
I've been overruled. Please.
Well, Section 1, you see a change, and I want to thank my legislative assistant, Marianne Almeida, for all her work on this. And Section 1, Sub 6, defines severe adverse conditions to exclude intentional or negligent action, making the land unfarmable, so just clarifying that for folks. Section 2, sub 1, sub H is a clarification, and I'm hitting the high points. There are obviously some technicals, but these are the high points. Section 2, 1, H clarifies farm use category. It adds to the different varieties of farm use category, implementing a remediation plan previously presented to the assessor for the county in which the land that is the subject of the plan is located. So, again, a clarification. Section 5, sub 4. On page 10, we were talking about this section just a moment ago. This does clarify that if you change from farmland within 5 years, that there would be additional taxes assessed, but not if the plan is implemented in good faith but fails to remediate to the land to make farm use practicable. So it adds some sideboards there that if you're doing your best faith effort to farm, then you would be exempt. But if you stop farming, you would go back 5 years for taxes there. The next change, Section 8, Sub 1, which is page 14 of the dash 2s, adds the word primarily to the machinery and equipment that would not be taxed under this plan. And then finally, Section 9. Which is page 15. We were running into some issues around the fiscal. You'll see there's a minimal fiscal now, allowing, instead of the Department of Ag, OSU Extension to help with developing the rules for remediation plans and allowing them to charge fees if it becomes onerous, depending on how many properties take advantage of this. And that's where we're at.
So the farm itself would pay for the cost of the of the work done by the Oregon State University Extension Service.
Right, Mr. Chair, they'd have that option to charge the applicant who's applying for the remediation plan if that seemed helpful to cover their costs, yes.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Berger.
Just to put me back in the picture, I remember hearing this, and this was a farm that had...
Cucumbers,
and what hurt the farm?
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, they had a fungus on their cucumber farm, and what they were trying to do over the course of several years was to add fill to raise the property to be able to farm again, and it was taking longer than expected, and the county came in with a tax assessment because they were no longer farming, but their goal is to farm again, and they have wheat on the property at this point, but they're hoping to go back to vegetables, which is what they've been raising for many, many years.
Okay, and I think I understood from what the Department of Revenue said, that this would, basically the dash two really only applies to this particular situation as written currently. There is no other farm that is in this situation that anybody knows of.
That is true, Mr. Chair, Representative Berger. And, when I was approached by constituents about this, I was a little hesitant because you don't want to write laws just for one property. But as we looked into it and got feedback from the Farm Bureau, we don't know if there are other properties that are having this issue that are in industrial land and they're farming, but they're having an issue. There's a challenge to farming, whatever it could be, some adverse condition. Right at this point, it applies to just the farm that is in my district, but it's unclear whether there will be others. But from a policy perspective, I think what we're trying to say is, if you want to continue to farm and you're having some issues, we want to continue to allow you to have that zoning so you can come back into farm use as soon as you can get a remediation solved. So I appreciate the question. Right now, it is just one property that would be affected.
Thank you. Representative Call.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Kotek, is there anything that's preventing Multnomah County from doing something like this on their own right now?
Mr. Chair, Representative Call, yes. They're not allowed to, right now statute says if you have not been farming for, if you stop, I say this right, you have if they have not farmed for more than a year, then it has to revert back to the other assessment. That is how the statute is written right now.
Okay.
We don't give discretion to the assessor. The assessor just follows the rule, whatever it is. Yes, please.
And you know, I know in other instances, Multnomah County has actually forgiven tax liability or taxes assessed. I think it takes simply a majority vote of the county board of commissioners. I think that that's correct. Has anything like that been undertaken to just, you know, have this case before them and see if, you know, they'll do the right thing so that we don't have to enact a statute?
Mr. Chair, Representative Call, the reason my constituents came to me is because they were told by the county that because of statute, they could do nothing else than what they were doing.
Okay.
Because they hadn't been farming for a year. And so, but thank you for the question.
Representative Springer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't want to assume, but it sounds like, Representative Kotek, this amendment gets your constituents where they need to be. Okay. Mm-hmm. And follow up, please. Mm-hmm. I know there was some conversation in the testimony regarding the severe adverse, well, getting to that point here, the severe adverse conditions on farmland, the first page going into the second page. Does that language have any concerns for you or your constituents and how this will be carried out?
Mr. Chair, Representative Springer, thank you for the question. My constituents have seen this. They're comfortable with the language. They understand that we're trying to have a broader policy conversation, but this will help them, but also, I think, help other farms. Thank you.
And one of the comments I made, I think, when you were last time, was that as we face change in the mean temperature in Oregon, which Oregon State Extension, I know, is very concerned about. I think it's very likely that longstanding farming practices may not work anymore on some lands, and that farmers are going to have to figure out how to do different things. And this will not. My suspicion is that this will not be the only farm that faces this kind of a problem as time goes on over the next 30 or 40 or 50 years. I'm hopeful that that's not true, but I wouldn't be surprised if it is. Representative Bailey.
Mr. Chair, just a comment that I think the Dash 2s have found a way to look at the broader public policy issue while at the same time calling out the great work that our Oregon State University Extension Service is providing to the state. So
that's
excellent point, Representative.
Doing one.
That's very true. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Is Multnomah County here? I think we'd like to hear from the county about this proposal.
Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee. For the record, Philip Kennedy Wong, Multnomah County. For the record, we do support the Dash 2 amendments, and we want to thank members of this committee, but especially also, Representative Kotek for seeing the broader state policy implications that this one particular case in our county represents, and we're definitely would be supportive of having the bill move forward.
Thank you. Questions, Representative Bailey?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Kenny Wong, are there, I'm not quite sure how to phrase this, but as you look to a remediation plan and how that applies to a specific property, are there other areas within the county that in your taxation system where you have a plan that is followed for looking at taxation? Do you have the capacity within your county to sort of examine that sort of plan, or is it purely because it's certified that that the county will be able to say, yep, in fact, that's a good plan, and we're ready to accept the implications it has for the taxation? Does that make sense?
Chair Barnhart and Representative Bailey, if I understand your question correctly, I mean, we would certainly defer to the Oregon State University Extension Services in certifying whether or not a remediation plan fits whatever you know, agreements that the property owner and in the program determines as what's best for remediation for that particular land. I mean, our purview is strictly limited to, you know, the assessment process with our county assessor, and if the authority that's you know that's given the Oregon State University system determines that this is a proper remediation plan, then we would proceed accordingly.
Thank you. Other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank
will
you.
Yes, Representative Berger.
I don't know if you've got other people on the list.
No,
but
I didn't have a list. But
it seems
to have grown.
I am still very concerned that this, when we do these kinds of things that is specified for one sort of purpose, one geographical or single issue, in this case farm, I'm very concerned that we're going to catch others in the net. If you would indulge me, I see the Farm Bureau is here. I'd like to hear from them that they don't believe this is there's a lot of
thank you.
Other properties that are affected in this way.
Let's do that. And thank you, Representative Berger. I think that was an excellent suggestion.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, good morning. For the record, my name is Sean Cleave, representing the Oregon Farm Bureau. I'd like to officially thank Representative Kotek for her leadership on this issue, also the Department of Revenue and Multnomah County. The work product you see in front of you is really a result of a lot of compromise and some forward thinking regarding how can you get a program to work for a particular constituent, but also a program that has some serious sideboards on it so that when a property qualifies for remediation and is identified and certified under extension, how the program would work moving forward. So I know that's a general statement, but maybe Chair Barnhart Berger, if you have any specifics.
Mr. Chair,
yes, please.
Could I ask, you have discussed this with your board, and you do believe this is not going to catch up others and would be a positive thing for farms in Oregon?
Oregon Farm Bureau believes it is a positive thing, Rep. Barnhart, Rep. Berger. It does have those provisions which provide that remediation period and the five-year clawback that guarantee that the property would stay into farming. So the opportunities for abuse are extremely minimized through that. The Fazio's had some discussions with me on a personal level regarding the length of the timeline, and ultimately I think that five-year timeline is good policy.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for indulging
thank
me.
You. Representative Call.
Yeah, I'd just like to ask a higher order question on what's happening here and try to get maybe the Farm Bureau's take on it. What we're talking about here is part of land use policy, to a certain extent a non-conforming use, and the state legislature stepping in to try to allow one piece of land to continue on in a use that is different from for which it was zoned. And I could see that in this specific instance, we're benefiting a piece of farmland, and so the Farm Bureau would be very supportive of it. But it seems to me in a great many other instances, if one of us had a constituent who wanted to maintain their land at its current use might actually cut against some of the values that the Farm Bureau has in place. And so what I guess I'm asking you is you know, this specific instance may actually benefit your constituent members, but taking the broad view, the kind of precedent that we set here might not necessarily do that. I'm wondering if you could speak to that.
Sure, Chair Barnhart, Representative Call, that is a good question. I will say that for the record, the Fazios are a fantastic farming family. It was the first time that I had met them this session. I truly believe that they have every intention to continue farming and have approached this issue with good faith. Frankly, as the UGB expands under our current system, all farms eventually get brought in. There are a variety of farms, particularly in the metro area, that are currently being farmed within that UGB, and it's only just a matter of time before they get purchased for other use, or you know, the rezoning happens on the fly. But ultimately, the landowner's choice regarding what they would like to do with that property is an individual choice, and that kind of illustrates the duplicitous nature of Oregon Farm Bureau's land use policy. We believe in protecting farmland, but we also, in certain cases, definitely support the right of the individual to make a choice regarding what their property is used or sold or converted to.
Representative Kelser.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I really appreciate your coming and sharing that perspective, and I really wanted to thank Representative Kotek. I think you know, farming and agriculture is really Oregon's history, and we forget about that sometimes, particularly in urban areas like Portland. And to have one of our last urban farms at risk due to a tax policy, I feel very comfortable supporting this bill. I think it's consistent with the value to our state. It's consistent with good constituent service, but it's also good policy. And I hope to see some more cucumbers coming out of Portland soon.
Good. Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move the -2 amendment to House Bill 2904.
Representative Riley moves the -2 amendment to House Bill 2904. Is there a discussion? Is there any objection to the -2? Seeing none, the motion is carried. Representative Riley.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2904 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Riley moves House Bill 2904 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Representative Berger.
Yeah, because of the discussion today, I had real reservations about this bill when I first heard it, but I am satisfied that we are really helping farms and not opening a door that we don't want to a whole bunch of special exemptions. So I appreciate the representative bringing it and the discussion today, and particularly the Farm Bureau coming forward and being on board. And I, too, hope to have some of those cucumbers right out of Portland someday. Thank you.
Wonderful. Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to pile on here, I think this has actually been this started out as a very specific bill, and I think the process has led to a great conversation around how we can take a specific issue and examine a broader public policy discussion and argument and come up with what I think is a bill that's going to allow for a much greater understanding and of the relationship between tax policy and our farm policy, especially in the face of global climate change and other issues that are going to come before us. So I commend the representative for her work in bringing stakeholders together and coming forward with a bill that we're having a lot of people here saying they can support.
Thank you. Representative Call.
Yeah, I too had reservations about this bill. I'm a yes vote today on this, although I would like to say that I feel like we've gotten into a discussion here about how to protect farmland within the UGB, which I think is a really important objective. But also a very important objective is to have an urban growth boundary with sufficient industrial land to make sure that all of the areas outside of the urban growth boundary are able to be maintained and preserved in their natural state. And that's a complicated balance. And to the extent that we here undermine the capacity of a region to bring industrial land online and allow industrial development to happen, it might actually put in danger the entire system of local land use policies that protect greater amounts of farmland. I do think that this is narrowly tailored enough to only apply to one specific parcel and does keep faith with my belief that we need to protect as much farmland as possible, and therefore I'm a yes vote.
Thank you. I would simply note that this bill doesn't refer to the UGB specifically, and I could easily imagine a farm far from any urban area that was found itself in a situation where it needed to use this policy that we're working on today. Is there anything further? Is there any objection to the motion, which is to move the bill to the floor with a due pass recommendation? I don't see any. The motion carries. The bill goes to the floor with a due pass. Representative Kotek, will you carry? Representative Kotek will carry the bill. We'll close the work session on House Bill 2904, and we'll open a work session on House Bill 2741. Colleagues, this bill is... do we have two identical amendments?
They're not identical.
They're not. Okay. Okay. Mazin, why don't you lead us through what we've got here?
Dear members of the committee, House Bill 2741, we've heard back on the 11th of March, and the two amendments in front of you try to do a couple of different things with the... How many amendments are in front of you?
Oh, I have the dash one and the dash two. Oh. Is there another one?
There's a dash three.
There's a dash three.
Do I have a dash three? I have a dash two.
All right, they must be in the packet, yes.
No.
The material for today.
I only have a dash two.
Well, that's the dash two.
Huh?
Oh, you have another one. There's a new one.
Amending as we speak.
Thank you.
Ah, this has to do with the comment made by Representative Gelser, I believe, during our last hearing.
Oh, nice.
The Gelser amendment.
Gelser amendment. Although I don't think you prepared it, did you?
I did not, but it's always nice to see something like this when you come to Revenue in the morning.
All right, we'll let Mazin walk us through this.
So the dash, just going back to the bill quickly to refresh your memory on this, the bill talks about, first of all, taking the way we do estate tax and then have a CPI indexing applied to the $1 million limit to bring it every year higher. And then takes the amount that our revenue generated from the state tax and puts it in the next generation fund. The next generation fund, 50% is for the Department of Education to fund Oregon pre-kindergarten program described under so-and-so, which is ORS 329-170. And the other 50% for the Student Assistance Commission. Now, the dash two amendment, what it does, it leaves everything in the bill the way it is, with the exception of taking out the indexing mechanism. So it leaves the limit, the threshold of the $1 million where it is today. And that's by taking out all the new language that has to deal with the index.
Page 2, lines 1 through 13.
Right.
Yes.
And then in the second page, when you have lines 1 through 5. and then goes back and adjusts and assigns the numbers to the different sections.
Oh, I see.
The -3 amendment, it does the same thing, and then it goes into the Oregon pre-kindergarten program and changes that 50% dedication of the revenue coming from the estate tax to the use of the early childhood education programs, and then goes back and renumbers things and changes the way things need to adjust accordingly. Those are the two differences between the...
Now, it also changes the date from January 1, 2010 to 2011.
That's correct.
I think those are the differences between the ones and twos, which are, I think are identical, and the -3.
Right.
Colleagues, this bill, we've been asked to move this bill to the Ways and Means Committee for its consideration. I asked for the removal of the indexing piece partly because there are huge things going on in the estate tax arena at the federal level, and we simply don't know where it's going to end up. And I'd like to consider larger changes in the taxing system at the time we know where the feds have settled, because they're not there yet. And then the other pieces deal with Representative Gelser's issue, and then the date change, I think, is primarily to allow time for this whole thing to settle into place. And I think that then gets us to the policy question for Ways and Means Committee, which is, do you want to set up a special fund and deposit this tax into that fund? And that, because it deals with the budget, is essentially a Ways and Means question. Yes, Representative Bailey.
Mr. Maybe there's a question for staff. Is it correct that neither the -2s nor the -3s changed the original bill to the extent that the original bill, I believe, unless I'm wrong, required all of the revenue from the estate tax to go into the Next Generation Fund? Is that still the same for the -2s and the -3s?
Yeah.
Representative Bailey, yes. That's correct.
Yeah, the only difference is that the -3s changes the 50, half of the fund that goes into the Oregon pre-kindergarten program to a fund for early childhood education programs, broader, a little broader, and that's the only change. Otherwise, the entire fund goes into the Next Generation Fund, half of which goes to the Oregon Student Assistance Commission for the purpose of funding grants through the Oregon Opportunity Grant Program, and then if the -3 is adopted, the other half goes to early childhood education programs. Representative Berger.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, remind me, this bill doesn't actually change the threshold as the -3s. It only changes where the money goes, or does it change the threshold?
It does not, Representative Berger, does not change the threshold.
That's right.
It leaves the threshold as it is today.
So it basically says any income tax, death tax revenue that comes into the state is then assigned to these programs. Is that what the bill actually does?
That's correct.
And we don't have any fiscal that says how much that is, or do I not have any fiscal?
Well, the amount of...
You kept it from me, or is it somewhere in this packet, or... I missed that.
No, I think
I missed that chapter.
The fiscal statement, this is going to Ways and Means. The fiscal statement for the -2 is the ones that we were looking at. -3, we don't have that immediately.
I don't have either, Mr. Chair, but it could be just me.
I don't think I have it either. Typically, when there's a minimal fiscal, I don't think it's distributed to the committee. We just rely on the statement of staff that we've received it.
Well, I guess it isn't a fiscal. I would like to know how much revenue. I guess I don't know how much revenue we're talking about assigning to these funds. And
we, the
the revenue impact statement from the first time we looked at this, we were talking about $100 million a year.
Okay, and that's what I don't have.
$100 million a year. There will be no net revenue impact because it will be moving from the general fund allocation that it gets today, and it will be going to another fund.
And the
Mr. Chair, that's the document that I'm missing, and I just would like revenue to electronically send that to my office if they would, because I don't have it in front of me, and I clearly don't have it, but it had to be there somewhere.
I note that the one I have is dated March 10th.
Yeah.
And I think we received it at the time of our initial hearing, which was March 11th. And we haven't done any work on this bill since that time. All right, what's your pleasure?
Mr. Chair, when you talk about sending it to Ways and Means, are you talking about with recommendation or without?
Well, I was assuming that we would send it with, but of course that's the committee's decision, not mine.
Mr. Chair, I could support it without.
Fine. Is there a motion?
Well, do we need to move the amendments, do we not?
Yes.
I would move.
Representative Bruin.
I'll move the Dash 3 amendments.
Representative Gelser.
Yes, I move the Dash 3 amendments to House Bill 2741.
Thank you. Representative Gelser moves the Dash 3 amendment to House Bill 2741. That's appropriate since you were the instigator of them. Is there any further discussion of the Dash 3s? Is there any objection to the Dash 3s? Seeing none, the motion is adopted. It's carried. Representative Gelser?
Mr. Chair, I would move House Bill 2741 as amended to the floor without recommendation, and that it be referred with a subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Thank you. Representative Gelser moves House Bill 2741 as amended to the floor without recommendation and a subsequent referral to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there any discussion? Representative Bailey.
Mr. Chair, I want to reiterate the comments that I made in the initial discussion of this bill. I very much support the idea of making sure we have a dedicated stream of funding to education of some kind. I also am glad that the Dash 3 amendments enlarge what we mean by funding for education. However, my concern still exists with this bill, and that is that by taking the entire amount of the estate tax and putting it into this fund, we remove flexibility within our funding system, and that it is important for us to maintain flexibility and the ability to make policy and budget decisions about where best to spend our funds, and I would be more happy if this bill took the volatility from the estate tax and placed it into a fund in order to remove the effect that volatility has on our tax system and our kicker system, rather than taking the entire amount of the revenue and putting it into that fund.
Thank you. Representative Brown.
Mr. Chair, I appreciate the fact that this bill is going without recommendation. I'll be supporting it. I would be a no if it were going with recommendation. For some of the reasons that Representative Bailey outlined, I still remain one of those folks that, with naive optimism, that someday, maybe not this session, Mr. Chair, but someday we'll actually get to tax reform in the state. And part of the problem that's inhibited our reform in the past has been that we do not have enough variables on the table. We need all tax variables on the table to truly get to comprehensive tax reform. This is probably a fairly small piece, but, well, I shouldn't say that. I think this is a significant piece of tax reform, and I think by tying our hands, by necessarily dedicating it even to phenomenal causes, ties the hands of the legislature and makes overall tax reform at some future date, hopefully sooner rather than later, more difficult to achieve.
Thank you. Anything else? Please call the roll, and the vote is on the referral to the Ways and Means Committee without recommendation.
Without recommendation.
Representative Bailey.
Aye.
Representative Bentz.
Aye.
Representative Berger.
Aye.
Representative Bruin.
Aye.
Representative Gelser.
Aye.
Representative Hall.
Aye.
Representative Reed.
Aye.
Representative Riley.
Aye.
Representative Springer.
Aye.
Chair Barnhart.
Aye. Well, that was a surprise. The motion carries unanimously, and the bill goes to Ways and Means without recommendation. And we'll close the work session on House Bill 2741. Colleagues, we do convene on the floor in 4 minutes. I want to note that we have an additional bill we have not gotten to yet this morning, and it's my intention to carry it over until tomorrow. In hopes that we get that done along with the other work we already have scheduled. That's House Bill 3465. Anything else? With that, committee is adjourned.
They said that we didn't have time.